So we should just briefly, you all got my message about this evening? Just so I can get a count of how many of you will be here, just to know how much, how many plates to put out and all that stuff. If everyone who's coming can raise their hand, so I'll get a count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12. Okay. And Maddie told me this morning that her dad was going to bake us a Bakewell tart for dessert. So I suppose if one other person wanted to bring some dessert of some sort, just for variety's sake, if we just leave it open-ended, then we'll get, yeah?
I love.
Okay. So I think we're all set. We're set on the dessert. We're set on the dessert front. I'll have a huge pot of a, it's a vegetarian stew that's referred to generically as vegetarian chili, but it isn't really chili. You'll see. It's a big stew with rice. I was just going to have sort of water and wine for drinks. If anybody wants anything else, any other kind of drinks, you can concoct stuff amongst yourselves and just bring them. But, you know, it's all super low key. It doesn't need a lot of planning. So the come any time after 7, but we'll plan to start at 6:30. There were a couple of people who said they would be a little bit later than that, so you're probably about a quarter till, you think, or how?
Yeah, I get out of class at 7:30, so I'll be taking them
Okay, so, okay. Anybody else? Just in terms of us having to lay the land on this. Okay. So, last time, on lecture 16's outline, we sort of ended more or less at Roman numeral 2.4, Klaus Offe's account of negative selection, negative selectivity of the state. And we were discussing his strategies for identifying systematically excluded possibilities. That's sort of where we ended. Just to remind you of the basic idea that's animating Offe's perspective, and then I'm just going to very briefly touch on this. I would rather get into the stuff of Terborn's analysis, which is more substantive, has more, I think, interesting substantive details, and then turn to today's topic. So Offe's basic point was, when we want to think of what it is that gives a state a class character, we want to say, yes, this is a capitalist state. It has a particular class character. What is it that we're really talking about? What he says is, what we're really talking about is that there's some systematic biasing mechanisms in the state, something that's built into the very way it's organized that biases it in one way or another. When we say it has a class character, we're saying that the biases have a class content to them. And then he asks, well, what does that really mean? And he says the way to think about it is in terms of what's excluded. A bias is really a bias that makes it not random what doesn't happen, but systematic what doesn't happen. Now, that's different from saying that a bias systematically determines what does happen. That's another way you could think of bias. It systematically determines what does happen. This is saying, no, a better way to think about it is that the bias systematically excludes things. Now, that's an interesting idea, because, of course, every exclusion is also an inclusion, you know, so you could look at it either way. I think it's a pretty nice point, though, to think of the way systematic biases occur is in the exclusions. This comes up also in a variety of discussions of culture and ideology, indeed in literary criticism. You know, the silences of a text are seen as important as what is said. Well, silences are the things that aren't spoken. And the question is, are the silences systematic, or are they just the things that haven't been said? You know, so in every conversation, there are lots of things you don't say, of course. Is there something systematic about what's not said? Now, the point here is that it could be the case that that's where the action is. It's the systematic exclusions that are really where the work of the institution is going. And as long as you've excluded the most harmful things from some point of view, then it doesn't matter what gets said. So one way of thinking about how capitalists secure their interests in the state is they just want to block all the things that are going to be harmful. Once they've done that, they can have a complete free-for-all. Let the chips fall where they may, among the non-excluded possibilities. If you could engineer the state to do it really neatly that way. So that's the way Offie frames the problem. Negative selectivity is the way he talks about it. I think that's a pretty useful idea, something that should be part of your menu. Of how you think about any problem. If you're in education, the curricula, the silences in the curriculum may turn out to be really where the action is and where the points of criticism. Why wasn't this included in the discussion of what we should talk about? Why is it off the table? But then this poses some problems. You know, it's obvious. There's an infinite number of things that aren't spoken, that don't happen. How do you know whether the ones that are excluded are being systematically excluded? And how do you even identify what's excluded? How do you get away from it simply being the particular opinions of the analyst, of the critic? Well, you haven't talked about what I think is important. I mean, I gave this, I think, little example about this course that before I came, the students were all head up and felt that this was systematically, because they'd read off, of course, at the time. They were convinced that the lack of a Marxist-oriented program was because of systematic exclusions of the bourgeois university. All it required was asking for it, and then it was included. That was proof that it hadn't been previously systematically excluded. It just hadn't yet been included. Now, it could have been, of course, the case that in the 1950s it was systematically excluded, that the exclusionary mechanisms had eroded as cultural and political and ideological changes that occurred, and that people just hadn't caught up with the new set of possibilities. You know, so this is all a very open and complicated arena to think about things. Well, the part of the discussion where we left off was a part where Offie is exploring the different ways in which you could make systematic claims about what's excluded. You know, how could you support, add credibility to a claim that something that hasn't happened has been systematically excluded rather than just hasn't happened yet. And he goes through a number of possibilities. You could use normative criteria. You could use kind of moral criteria for deciding what's systematically excluded. You could talk about objective interests. You could say that these things are excluded because of the interests involved. You can do empirical comparisons. The empirical comparisons is pretty interesting. There's a famous study by Matthew Crenson. This was a, I think, 1970s study called The Unpolitics of Air Pollution. Unpolitics, it's a nice term. And it was basically asking the question why some cities had, at that time, some pollution serious pollution regulation and others didn't. And not only why some had it and why some didn't, but why in some cities it was never even on the agenda of the city council. So that's the key issue. It wasn't even on the table. It wasn't even part of public discussion. Whereas other cities, it was a big part of the public discussion. And his argument was basically that in cities where there were really powerful interests of employment and taxes connected to polluting industries, nobody wanted to talk about it. Whereas in cities where pollution was a problem, but it was the result of diffuse sources, not concentrated sources with power, it was talked about. And unpolitics was used as a way of talking about non-events, that is the non-discussion of pollution, by virtue of the universality of the interests that came into play, that is, workers' jobs were at stake, not just profits of capitalists, if you actually tried to control the pollution, was the argument. And that's an example where you validate the claim that in, let's say, Cleveland, it's not discussed, but in Milwaukee it is. I mean, I don't know if that, I don't remember the study well enough to tell you if those are the right comparisons, by saying, well, this is how the two cities vary. It is discussed in Milwaukee. It's not discussed in Cleveland. Here's a structural difference between these two cities that would explain the exclusion. And that validates the claim that it is an exclusion by doing that comparison. Office says, that's great. The problem is it doesn't help you deal with things that are excluded everywhere. So it's a pretty good thing for studying exclusionary processes that vary across capitalist cities, but not exclusionary processes that are universal by virtue of them being capitalist cities. His final conclusion is that really, in the end, the real limits of possibility that are created by negative selections are really only observable in special historical circumstances in which they're challenged and transformed. It's really when the exclusionary mechanisms enter into crisis that you observe how they operate. This is a little bit like, you know, psychoanalysis saying that neuroses are a way of studying normal functioning because it shows you the pathologies help reveal the failure of ordinary mechanisms, and you get a better understanding of how the ordinary containment of our repressed desires works when the containment process breaks down. I mean, that's a common Freudian claim about why study pathology. Pathology is a window into normality. Normality works by having all sorts of repressed desires. And when it really works well and fully integrated, you don't observe it because you don't even experience the repressed desire because it's being done, it's being repressed effectively. Well, you can study that when the repression mechanisms break down. Well, the same point Offie is making here. And essentially, what that means from the point of view of a researcher means if you're making these very strong claims about exclusionary mechanisms, you're not going to be able to actually empirically observe it in many contexts. To actually get empirical evidence about exclusions, the really deep exclusions that are really putting things off the table, the way to test those limits is by struggling against them. And then when the historical moments occur where the exclusionary mechanisms begin to fray, then you can retrospectively see how they were working by virtue of the comparison with the context in which they've been effectively challenged. So studying things like the breach in the way in which politics was organized in Chiapas with the Zapatistas and the way they put things on the table that had been previously off the table everywhere in Mexico. And you see those breaches, that then by comparison with other communities enables you to see how these mechanisms work. This is a particular way then of thinking about the relationship between theory and practice also. And for those of you who are familiar with it, there's a certain aspect of what's sometimes called action research, where the researcher is an organic participant in a social struggle, not an outside observer, where you're constantly testing the limits and you're involving your comrades in the research project. And there's all sorts of other things in action research, but this is a way of then thinking about a very demanding kind of research context for studying certain deep features of a social structure. All right, let's move on to Terborn. Are there any, remember, for these lectures, because I've been unable to pare this down to a manageable amount in the limited number of sessions, in addition to having our discussion tonight to remedy this gap, feel free to ask questions as we go rather than just wait till the non-existent end of class when there's time for it. So any thoughts or issues around these these points that in Klaus Hoffe's work. The kind of take home, I mean, if you want to make a little asterisks around take home messages, I think this notion of thinking about the negative selections, the exclusions, thinking about that as mechanisms rather than just absences. And in whatever context you're doing your research, it's a really helpful way, even if you can't get empirical traction on it. So if you can't get empirical traction, you can't get empirical traction. You know, that's life. Some problems you can't study. It's still worth being sensitive to it. And in your writing, if there's a problem for which the issue of negative selection exclusion is really theoretically important, but you can't study it, you should say that. You know, that's the way to deal with the things you can't actually study, is not to then say, because you can't study them, it's not worth talking about. No, to say, look, what you really think is going on here is that there are certain exclusions. There are certain biases that are making certain things not happen. I can't really provide evidence for that, other than kind of anecdotal and suggestive evidence. But I'm going to assume that in order to have a different way of thinking about what is happening. That's fine. I think transparency and making it clear is fine. And it does help to set the stage for how you would actually go about exploring what does happen, knowing that there's these non-events that are being continually put off the table. All right, what makes the capitalist state a capitalist state? This is the central question that Terborn asks. He wants to go beyond just asserting this in a very general way to actually create an empirical inventory of the real properties of the state that infuse it with a class character. The core concept that is used to really drive this is the concept of state apparatus. State apparatus, which is contrasted to state power. So that couplet, state apparatus and state power, that's the kind of key couplet that is carried out throughout Terborn's work. The term state apparatus had a certain popularity in the theories of the state discussions of the 70s, late 60s and 70s. It kind of petered out in the 80s. You don't really see that term used that much anymore. You know, you talk about state structures, state institutions, state organizations. The notion of the state apparatus is, I don't think you encounter that much in contemporary discussions. I kind of like it, but that's probably just mainly because I grew up with it. You know, it's when my intellectual formation was consolidating, that's what we talked about, state apparatuses. What's the class character of the state apparatus? I don't think it has any particularly special meaning that state organization or state structure would do the job less well. But I'm going to use it both because Terborn does and it's because one of the terms that I've adopted for understanding these things. So what's a state apparatus? The state apparatus is the machinery of the state through which state power is exercised. The state apparatus is kind of like means of production with respect to the economic structure. Right? So the means of production are the way in which nature is transformed and the power of capital is exercised through the use of, through the means of production which it purchases. State apparatus is kind of an analogous idea. It's the institutional structures through which state power is exercised. Well, what then is state power? You know, so these two terms have this very deep connection. Terborn's exposition is not as clear as I would like. Mostly, I think his writing is pretty clear for somebody who's writing in this more structuralist vein. Sometimes I find his turns a phrase around the discussion of state power a bit obscure. Basically, I think the idea of state power is the capacity of the state to produce effects in the world. So it's pretty close to the general concept of power that I was talking about. Power is the capacity to do things. This is the capacity to produce effects in the world. This is pretty close. You know, I emphasize the word transform. Power is the ability to transform things. And this is the power is the ability or the capacity to produce effects. That's pretty close, and for all practical purposes. These effects are generated through the use of apparatuses. So Office thesis is very much like, I mean, Terrebonne's is very much like Office, that these apparatuses have a class character in the sense that they're biased in the kinds of effects in the world they produce. They don't produce every possible effect. They are biased in the kinds of effects they produce. They're biased in the kinds of consequences which can be generated through the use of this machinery. Again, this is a very general idea. One could, you know, one can imagine this being applied to all sorts of other domains. One could talk about certain kinds of machines used in production are not really usable under a democratic firm. One could imagine. Some people have argued that the assembly line of the form that was developed in the early 20th century has a capitalist bias in it. That working on an assembly line produces idiot workers. I mean, to say it in the harshest form. I mean, I'm not impugning the intelligence of the workers, obviously. And that in a democratically organized firm, those means of production would not be organized that way because those effects would be considered too damaging. And if you want to have empowered and participatory and engaged workers who are good at problem solving, you cannot have a Fordist assembly line. You'd have to work out a different way of organizing it. And if you can't, because the level of forces of production and the productivity that that produces requires an assembly line, if you can't do it differently, then you're going to be, and you want to organize the firm democratically, you're going to have a constant tension between the kinds of subjectivities which are being cultivated by the way the production system is being organized and the kinds of subjects you need in order to organize it democratically. There'll be this constant battle between the daily routines of work, which are suffocating, and the demands of participation, which are require, you know, vibrant, energized, problem-solving people. Well, there was a very interesting debate in the 70s about class biases in the forces of production themselves, which had exactly that character. And it's the same point about state machinery. The very way it's organized has class consequences, meaning only certain kinds of effects can be produced with those machines, those apparatuses. The strongest version of this, which is stronger really than Terrebonne is saying, is that these apparatuses are structured in such a way as to ensure the production of effects which reproduce capitalism and the power of capitalists. So it's really the strong functionalist argument. The class character of these apparatuses is so well suited for capitalism that is, once you get that kind of state in place, it's going to generate class reproductive effects of the system. The weaker version is simply that it excludes the most anti-capitalist possibilities. That these apparatuses are designed to make it extremely unlikely that the state is going to engage in anti-capitalist practices. But it doesn't by any means ensure that the state produces the best effects for capitalism. The weak version seems to me the only sustainable one. I mean, states do so many stupid things that aren't optimal for capitalism that it's hard to take seriously the strong version. that the state doesn't merely exclude the most disruptive anti-capitalist practices, but it also somehow manages to guarantee the selection of the optimal functionality for capitalism. So the weak version, which is the offa interpretation, negative exclusions are what the state is doing, and I think it's really what is in the spirit of Terborn's as well. Now, what Terborn does, which other theorists haven't been so bold as to do, and which I think is really exemplary, is he sticks his neck out and says, all right, if I'm going to say the state has these, its very machinery has these class biases, damn it, I'm going to tell you what the aspects of the state are that do it. And he doesn't say it quite this way. And I may be wrong about some of these, but if I'm wrong, correct me. Right? He doesn't quite go to the full transparency, and this is my best shot, tell me how to improve it sort of approach. But I think it's kind of the spirit of what he's doing. None of the other theorists who are writing on at this time about these things attempted to give you an inventory, an actual set of propositions about how the biasing class character of the state is actually inscribed in its institutions and in what ways. And he does this by saying that there are 11, I think, my notes say 11, I didn't check to see if I got that right. There are 11 different aspects of the state. He broke it down into the selection of tasks and the internal organization and the nature of its outputs. You know, he has this kind of organizational sociology flow model of inputs and processing and outputs of the state. And then he went through each of these 11 and says, this is what renders the capitalist state a capitalist state. And to do that, he adopts, I think, an extremely interesting methodological device. He says, look, if we're going to say this is a capitalist state, it's the way we understand that is by contrast to non-capitalist states. And what are the available contrasts? So he wants to make this also an empirical set of claims. The non-capitalist contrasts are, on the one hand, the feudal state. So that's a good, historical, robust contrast. We can compare how certain kinds of features of the state are organized abstractly in states that are capitalist and in states that are feudal. So one part of the contrast is backward looking to the feudal state. And the other contrast is a little more problematic. It's forward looking to the socialist state. Now, Terborn, writing in the 70s, took the historical experiments that went under the name of socialism as examples of a socialist state, but of socialist states that had gone awry. He was not a defender of the Soviet Union. He was very critical of it. But nevertheless, he thought that there were properties of that state which would help us inform theoretical claims about what a socialist state would be like. It's just that just as capitalist states have, you know, good liberal democratic forms and fascist forms, we have authoritarian capitalist states, you can have democratic and liberal in the sense of individual liberties, socialist states and authoritarian socialist states. So he is still operating in a framework where what were then called actually existing socialism, that was always in kind of quotes, you know, actually existing socialism, could be used as evidence for what a socialist state would be like. Well, I think for purposes of reading Terborn, the most constructive thing to do is just to suspend your criticism of that point. It's, you know, it's very easy now, especially. We're 40 years later. We know what those societies were like better than we did then. The illusions are stripped away. It's easier to kind of really attack him for that. A lot of what he says about those states is what people would like to have been true about them rather than what was true about them. But I think for the purposes of the theoretical elaboration, it's still useful. Yeah?
How do you assess the interpretation that some provided in terms of Marxian scheme the real world state social societies were employing the Asian mode of production?
I think the concept of the Asian mode of production is an incoherent one. First of all, the name is silly. I mean, it's totally un-Marxist to define a mode of production by a geography rather than by a concept. So it's much better, the alternative name for what for the Asian mode of production is a tributary mode of production, which defines a mechanism rather than a location. But I don't think it's a very useful concept. My own interpretation of the state socialist economies is that they were what I would call a statist organization of economic structures rather than a socialist one. So I distinguish capitalism, statism, and socialism. But you know, there's various other kinds of solutions. For Terborne's point, he's really trying to theorize an ideal type in which there's some connection to the historical record of these societies, but it's a connection that's based on a kind of wishful thinking view of how those societies worked rather than an accurate account. And again, I think it's best to bracket the criticisms of that part because the main purpose of it is to understand the specificity of the capitalist state. And the account of the socialist state in his book is useful as an abstract model in helping to give precision to the capitalist case. And that's where the argument is it's at its best. Do you understand that move that I'm proposing here? Yeah.
So I'm going to make a confession that I haven't read Terborne yet.
I'm shocked. A student that hasn't read everything before. I'll put a big black mark and no.
So I have a quick question about, is he talking then more so about like Soviet Union over the entire span up until he is writing, or is he talking, because you can make the argument that there were some progressive things about what the Soviet Union did, especially directly after 1960?
Right. He's not talking about the early 20s. No, he's giving a characterization of certain features of that state apparatus, which he felt were enduring properties, abstractly understood. You know, so it's abstracting from the deformations that occurred. So just as we could say, just as an example, we can say that one feature of the capitalist state, which this is one of the things we'll be talking about in a moment, is how it draws the distinction between the public and the private. So every state has to deal with this question. Every state, in terms of selecting what is its business, what is it going to do, has to draw a demarcation between the public and the private. The private are the things the state doesn't do. It leaves that up to individuals. The public are the proper domain of state action. So you have to draw the public-private distinction. The key point in capitalism is that the public-private distinction is drawn as two separable spheres. So they're quite separate. They're not interpenetrated and overlapping. They're quite separate. And the guts of the private sphere is anchored in the notion of private property. Now, that was true in Nazi Germany, in liberal 19th century Britain, and in contemporary the United States. In each case, there were fuzzy areas, so the private property of Jews was considered part of the public responsibility of the state. They had no private property rights. So there was this peculiar, because of the racism of the Nazis, this very peculiar violation. But in other respects, the Nazis, even as the war began to unravel for them, you know, and you might have expected them to simply start appropriating stuff from private. No, they were very respectful. And the rule of law around contracts was pretty much continued right through the whole, you know, totalitarian period in Germany. That, Terborne would say, is a deep fact about the Nazi regime, which reflected that it remained a capitalist state in spite of its undemocratic, authoritarian, and illiberal character in so many other respects. It still maintained the public-private distinction as part of what the state was like. You see, that's an aspect of the state, its jurisdictional reach being demarcated by a particular way of drawing the public-private distinction. The feudal state is very different in that respect. So in the feudal state, the public is absorbed into the private domain of the king, the properties and lands that the king owns and controls as by virtue of feudal land rights, is also the domain of the state. The public is absorbed into the private. And the complicated hierarchies between barons and schmarons and knights and all that stuff all involve this interpenetration of the public and the private rather than a clear separation. But it's an interpenetration in which the public is in a sense privatized under the will of the feudal lord. In socialism, Terborn argues, the private is in some sense subordinated to the public. That is, the public is the encompassing notion. We're all democratically, in the kind of democratic vision, deciding what aspects of life should be left up to persons and what aspects of life are to be coordinated collectively. It's not pre-given prior to collective deliberation. It's not given by natural law. It's not given by some theory about private property as being pre-social. No, in a socialist society, it's a collective deliberative decision how we are going to draw the boundary lines between public and private. So it's a public matter what the public-private demarcation is, and it can't be decided prior to the public deliberation. Right? Now that's a pretty scary vision, I think, for liberal, for those of us liberal individualists grew up in capitalism, where a certain notion of the sanctity of this boundary, which is anchored in private property but which extends to all sorts of other individual rights, seems pretty secure, and you can use it against the state if the state encroaches on it. What Terborn is saying in a socialist thing, no, it's not like that. In a socialist world, it's a collective, deliberative, democratic process. Now, if these individual autonomy rights are important to the people in a democratic, deliberative process, they will indeed secure them as real boundaries. You don't mess with me on that, because that's what collectively people want. But it's not pre-given by virtue of some natural state. Well, I think he's probably right. If you're going to take the notion of a profoundly and pervasively democratic society seriously, which is what I think is at the core of socialism, then you don't have a pre-social determination of the boundary between public and private. It's something to be negotiated and accomplished through collective deliberation. Whereas the capitalist view is, no, you have a pre-political division between public and private. And then the state is created to accomplish the public purposes. And in feudalism, you have only the private, and the state is created out of the private power of lords. Yeah.
So let's say in a very utopian society, you have a socialism, democratic, collective state, and the people decide that, yeah, they want public and private. Do you think that demarcation will then move, transform the state into capitalism eventually, or can you retain this, a socialism?
So I would, my view is, again, and speaking in this more utopian mode,
yeah,
is that they would not anchor it in private property. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't make that mistake. That is so that it is true that there are aspects of life that should be left up to people without the intervention of the collective. It just turns out that private property isn't one of them. Mm-hmm. Private property in the means of production isn't one of them. And that's the anchor for the public-private distinction, which brings with it these big ramifications. Because what it does is it blocks the state from intervening and acting in ways that are in the collective interests by virtue of the sanctity of private property. And that was its purpose, of course. The reason for treating private property as a pre-political constraint on the state. You know, that's what liberal political theorists argued. It's a pre-political constraint on what the state can legitimately do. It doesn't have to be negotiated. It's supposed to be there as an, you know, in nature. Natural right is the way that was often defended. This also bears on an issue which we probably won't have time to look at deeply, but the question of the gendered character of the state, because there's another version of the public-private distinction which centers around sex and gender and patriarchy, most sharply focused in the current era around reproductive rights. Right, so they claim the state has no business telling women what to do with their bodies, is a pretty interesting claim. You know, it's a defense of a really strong public-private boundary. It says that this is a boundary which public authority has no business crossing. It's often defended in very capitalist ways. That is, this is pre-political. It's viewed as a natural right. Right? It's a, you know, it's a really interesting issue. Now, I'm a complete defender of reproductive rights and so on, because I think it's a necessary condition for human flourishing. You know, I think that that kind of bodily autonomy is really important for human flourishing. There are conditions under which I get uncertain as to whether I'm right about that. Right? So, you know, I tend to be pretty much on the liberal, in classical liberal sense of valuing individual autonomy and the sanctity of that boundary. But there are arguments around, for example, whether people should be required to be organ donor. You know, on your driver's license, you can stipulate that if you're killed in a car crash, your organs can be donated to save somebody else's life. So one question is, should that be a free choice, or should it just be a rule that everybody has to, on their death, have their organs available to save lives? Well, I pretty much on that one go on the violation of individual autonomy. I don't feel the trade-offs on that, you know, that particular aspect of the, you should be in control of your own body and say what is going to happen to it. I'm pretty much probably saying it should be required rather than just an option. But I understand the politics of it and the practical problems, but I don't find that objectionable. Well, that means that I'm prepared in a democratic forum where we would be able to make such decisions. I would be prepared to vote with and support the view that says, no, we're going to violate the public-private boundary around personal bodily control with respect to what happens to your body when you're dead, that you don't have the right to control that. It's a collective resource, so to speak, once you're dead. But not once you're alive. So I'd be very hesitant to have forced kidney transplants, you know, to have donor matching and have people be forced to give up a kidney even if they didn't want to, even if it would save the life of another person. You know, that makes me very nervous, but the other one doesn't. Well, I'm meandering here. This is, shall we say, not in my notes. The point is to just emphasize this idea that the public-private boundary has to be drawn everywhere. Every state has to figure that out one way or another. It's drawn in a particular way in a capitalist state, and that's one of the constitutive features that renders a state a capitalist state, drawing it in that way and anchoring the distinction in a strong notion of private property. And a socialist state draws the distinction differently. And Terborn then uses the empirical example of how it was drawn in the Soviet Union to illustrate that argument, that the public-private boundary is drawn differently in the Soviet Union. It's negotiated in a different way. And again, I think that's useful as a way of illustrating the specificity of the capitalist case. Yeah.
I think that what you're talking about here raises an interesting question about what is the collective. Like, because you can think of a collective in terms of a million people, or you can think of it in terms of a city voting on things, and then you can also think about Like one thing that comes to mind is like the right of nations to self-determination, and like how would that be infringed upon potentially by viewing the collective as bigger or smaller?
Yeah.
And so like,
so all of these things become problematic. You know, all of these things have to be figured out. So on that particular question about the nation state, that's another one of his organizational properties of the state. How states deal with their relationship to other states. What's the nature of that connection? And the forms of accountability and conflict resolution between them, and the possibilities of intervention between them. And that's drawn different. That's organized differently in feudalism, capitalism, and in socialism. So yeah, all of these would be instances of things you'd have to worry about. Yeah.
My question kind of goes back to the reproductive rights thing and the public-private distinction. Like, if women's bodies, when they're pregnant, become like public property almost in this capitalist context, like what does that mean for the like boundary that you were saying?
So my view is that actually abortion rights and reproductive freedom is ridding the capitalist state of pre-capitalist restrictions on individual autonomy.
Okay.
That it's actually reproductive rights is more consistent with the properties of the capitalist state, which give people full property rights in themselves. You know, and that there is an incomplete. When we abolished slavery, we moved one major step towards giving people full self-ownership, full property rights in themselves. But various kinds of religious traditions, which had a non-capitalist character, interfered with the full realization of the self-ownership principle. Self-ownership is a capitalist principle, the notion that you own yourself and your own labor power. And then the question of reproductive rights, which also has to do with sexuality rights, you know, around homosexuality and other matters, lag behind these other aspects of self-ownership. The aspects of self-ownership which had the most directly economic character were fully realized first. So women's rights to full participation in labor markets, for example, which previously had been restricted. You know, women didn't have full labor market rights in the United States until the 70s, you know, or whenever the Title IX and those things were, maybe late 60s and 70s. In the Netherlands, married women were not allowed to be school teachers. You know, if you got married, you until the 60s, you know. So the fact that if you were a married woman, you had to quit your job if you were a school teacher, that is means that full bourgeois self-ownership rights haven't yet been extended to women. Well, the labor market rights are fully extended to women. Property rights are fully extended to women now. They can own anything. They can sell it. But the reproductive rights aspect, which is the part of self-ownership which is least directly concerned with ordinary capitalist economic relations, that's lagged behind. And I think it's basically because of the non-capitalist character of the social processes which are invested in that particular distinction. But I think, I mean, in spite of the United States being so retrograde in these terms, I think the general trajectory into the future is for those rights to be deepened and extended rather than really reversed. This also has to do with this theme that the parallel theme to is the state a state in capitalist society or is it a capitalist state? You can ask the same question around gender. Is the state a patriarchal state or a state in a patriarchal society? So this particular issue, how do you draw the public-private distinction in gendered terms? That's one of the things that lends support to the view. No, it's not just that it's a state that exists in a world in which there's male domination, but the state itself inscribes that domination. in various aspects. And this issue of how the public-private distinction is drawn around reproduction would be an example. That's built into the state. It's not just, although it's being gradually eroded. Yeah.
So it sounds like in like both the Uffy and the Ortho, how do you say it? Or on the third pieces. Like the state has like definable boundaries, definable apparatuses. Like we know where it ends and where it begins.
Right.
But in this, in the Shavorsky.
Shavorsky. Just pretend it's SH, just Shavorsky.
Shavorsky book, where they talk about Gramsci's conception about the relation between the state and civil society. There's this part where it says that for Gramsci, all institutions that participate in reproducing capitalist social relations constitute elements of the state. And a little further on, and yet every institution which participates in the production of capitalist relations is a part of the state. Institutional distinctions of public and private are internal to bourgeois ideology.
Right. So,
this
comes out of Althusser. I mean, Gramsci may have said this in a very loose way. Althusser wrote a famous set of essays that were collected in a book called Ideological and Repressive State Apparatuses, in which he calls the family, the church, schools, everything that reproduces capitalist social relations are part of the state. So the state simply becomes all the state is everything that reproduces capitalist relations, not a particular structural form of reproduction, namely concentrated apparatuses of domination over territory. I think that that's a completely unhelpful way of using the term state. I think it caused enormous confusion and lots of debates that didn't go anywhere. And there's, for good reason, it's dropped. I mean, nobody these days talks about the family being a part of the state. You know, even if you think of the family as a repressive institution that controls people in all sorts of ways, people will say the state regulates families, the state sets laws which determine the parameters under what kinds of families have what kinds of capacities. I mean, all of that's true. But very few, I mean, I haven't read anything in years in which people treat the family as just another branch of the state, right? And so even though Gramsci may have alluded to that, I don't think that's a helpful way of thinking about it. Okay, yeah?
So the political, I mean, for something that's political, does it have to be directly related to the state?
Right, so the notion of politics, I do think it's perfectly fine to talk about the politics in the family and political conflict in the family. And the feminist, you know, little slogan, the personal is political, does make sense because there are social relations that bind together the lives of people within intimate relations. And those social relations both involve power and they can be the object of transformation. So when in a couple, people are struggling over the division of labor and how to share the work and how to share responsibility, when they're struggling over trying to stabilize a more egalitarian and reciprocal form of relationships internal to their intimate lives, I think they're engaged in a political practice because they're taking as an object of their conscious agency the production and transformation of social relations. And that's what politics is. Now, it's a particular kind of politics. It's micropolitics, not macro. It's personal politics, not public politics. It can be publicized, you know, made more public, and then one might think of it as more politicized in a broader sense when it becomes part of a social movement. So in the women's liberation era, when that term was used to describe the collective struggles of people's micro practices, you know, so there'd be public events, and sometimes small, sometimes large, around consciousness raising for the purpose of transforming social relations, well, that's a broader extension than out of the micro settings of one's own life. And then that broader extension was interiorized within those micro settings. So in that era, the women's in quotes, I'm going to be using scare quotes, so, you know, women's libbers who were radicalized in the public arenas where these issues were taught would bring it into the family. and enter into contestation around it. And they would develop skills in the public arena that they could deploy in those micro settings. And sometimes with very disruptive and ultimately dissolving effects. I mean, families couldn't, given relations, couldn't withstand that kind of pressure. And so the transformation of the relation was a dissolution of the relation. But other times, actually, transformations occurred. You know, it's quite variable what happened. So, I think that is political. It can spill over to the state when people begin to realize, in order to really stably transform these relations in a broad way, not just in my household where we've got such close and respectful relations that we can really work on this effectively, but in the broader societal, we got to change part of the environment. We got to create universal good quality childcare. That's going to relieve pressures on families, which will enable them to forge new relations. In the absence of good quality childcare outside the home, it's just tough to cope with all the strains and pressures on our own. So sometimes then the micro politics of struggle over transformations, which are politics still at the micro level, can trigger a realization that we have to change the parameters, the outside environment, and that may require the state, because you'll have to use collective resources in order to make that possible. Yeah.
By the way, the juvenile judiciary in traditional societies is viewed as a kind of intervention of state into kind of family life. So the parents should decide how to treat their children and not the state, which is kind of good or bad. I mean, that kind of state can sue parents for kind of not giving children free time or kind of playing computer games. Kind of is kind of. In the law, that kind of children have certain rights, but in traditional societies, it's all on families.
Yeah. So, well, particularly on the head of household, which would be the male, had essentially repressive rights. You know, wife beating, child beating, disciplinary actions were authorized by this, and in a sense delegated, sometimes through silences, not through explicit delegation, but it's. It wasn't typically in the law. The male head of household has the right to beat the members of its household with the following instruments of torture. No, it was not usually specified. I don't know if it was ever specified to that degree. Well, there's an urban legend about this stick the size of it was never in a statute. It was just by custom, but not by statute. Okay. Well, we've gone through the first of the illustration of some class attributes, the selection of tasks, which is about this public-private distinction. I think what we should do is take our break, and I'm going to just very quickly mention some of these other points, and then at least begin the discussion of the capitalist state and accumulation. Okay, so let's take a break, come back at 12 after, 7 minutes.
I have one more question. Sure.